Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar that will discuss an important legal trend in the ARM industry, defensive strategies against reverse Avila lawsuits. We'll explain exactly what that is and hear from a panel of ARM industry experts who will share their insights into managing this issue. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Barron & Neuberger. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I also want to take a minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and the Getting to Know Profile series, as well as hosts webinars and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. For example, the site announced this morning that it has launched its first ever podcast. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what the site has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Katie Neal is the Compliance and Litigation Counsel for ARS National Services, which is a third-party collection agency. In her role, she manages all aspects of litigation, including establishing a litigation strategy and managing outside counsel. Prior to joining ARS, Katie was a litigator at a law firm in North Carolina. She is licensed to practice law in California and North Carolina. Jed Peek is responsible for the creation, implementation, and continual oversight of the enterprise-wide compliance management system at the Frost Arnett Company. In this role, he ensures that the compliance program aligns with the overall corporate strategy, business plan, and code of ethics at Frost Arnett. Jed also oversees multiple compliance information tracking and monitoring systems. Prior to his role as chief compliance officer, Jed spent 16 years as an attorney in private practice, specializing in employee relations issues. Arthur Sanders manages the New York office of Barron & Neuberger PC and works in the firm's Consumer Financial Services Law Practice Group. His practice is devoted primarily to the defense of collection agencies, law firms, and creditors engaged in the practice of debt collection. His expertise in compliance issues is a result of over a quarter of a century in representing creditors and debt collectors. The format for today's webinar will be an audio discussion moderated by me. There is no video component, so if you're not seeing anything on your screens, you're not missing anything. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion is concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Also, today's webinar is being recorded. A recording of the event will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, before we launch into the discussion, I want to read the following disclaimer. The information shared today is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not his or her organization. And with that, let's begin today's discussion. So before we discuss what a reverse Avila lawsuit is, let's start with talking about what an Avila lawsuit is. And Katie, I'll ask you to maybe break that down for us.
Sure, no problem. So Avila is a case that was decided by the Second Circuit where the court essentially said that if the account is accruing interest, the consumer needs to be made aware of that in the letters. Otherwise, it violates the FDCPA. And the main thing that the court there was trying to solve for was a consumer mailing in a payment for the amount that was received on the letter, only to have interest to have accrued between the time the payment was made versus when the payment was processed, causing the collection agency to continue collecting whatever interest accrued and just basically perpetuating the collection process. In its decision, Avila, the Second Circuit provided a certain safe harbor language, which is the Miller language out of the Seventh Circuit, I believe, which basically discloses to the consumer that, hey, interest on your account may accrue or is accruing, so the amount may be different at the time your payment is received. And the court also gave a second way out, a second safe harbor in its decision by saying that the agency would essentially still be protected if they told the consumer that they will accept a certain amount by a certain date, and that would resolve the account. So that is Avila, and it started from, and I'm pretty sure that people who are collecting on accounts that are currently accruing interest still, like pre-charge-off accounts, they're probably still seeing these claims. So it's basically a claim saying that the agency, for whatever reason, failed to let the consumer know that interest is accruing on the account.
Okay, so now that we know what an Avila lawsuit is, let's dig into what a reverse Avila lawsuit is. And Arthur, maybe I'll ask you to give us a little bit of background on that.
Okay, in New York, there are quite a few what I call, or what many people call, reverse Avila lawsuits. So in that lawsuit, there's a couple different versions of it. One of the versions basically says that you have to disclose whether or not interest is running on the account, even when interest is not running on the account. And this also applies to costs and fees as well. And as you know, the Avila case didn't deal with the fact pattern or the situation where interest was not running or it wasn't accruing. And so one version of a reverse Avila claim is simply alleging that there has to be a disclosure whether interest is running or not. Another version of a reverse Avila claim is simply alleging that interest is running, even if the collection agency isn't attempting to collect it. So far, the plaintiffs in the various cases have not met with any success, but in a few minutes, I'll go into a couple other issues with respect to it. I'm not convinced that the record of success we've had so far on the defense side is going to continue. But for now, the defense side is one. Every reverse Avila case that I've seen.
Mike, this is Judd. You know, in kind of encapsulating these types of claims, I throw it back to the what's known as the law of unintended consequences. I mean, Avila seems rational in its logic. If you are collecting Y or collecting X, then you have to disclose Y. But it's this unintended consequence where the plaintiff's bar has decided, well, if you're not doing X or collecting X, then you have to disclose Z. So it's with this created when Avila created this additional burden of disclosure. It's being argued that, well, you have the burden of the opposite disclosure as well, that you're not doing something that you could otherwise be doing. And that's really I don't think Avila intended that to be the consequence, but that's where the plaintiff's bar has run with it.
To kind of follow up on that, one thing that I've seen as well recently, so obviously when these claims started coming in, we added some language to our letters that essentially says, the second prong of Avila, right? That if you pay this amount, your account will be paid in full. And now we're seeing claims from the consumer attorneys, which kind of like Judd said, is a unintended consequence from the Second Circuit about that. Because now they're saying that if you include that language, then it sort of implies that after the account, after that date, after the account's no longer with your agency, then it may increase, and therefore it's creating a false sense of urgency to get the consumer to pay while the account is with your office. And it's just kind of fresh, in my opinion, to receive these claims from the same plaintiff's counsel who, in the Taylor oral arguments, argued that, hey, guess what? By not including a disclosure that interest may increase at some point in time in the future, you're being false and deceptive because even though you're not collecting the interest now, that doesn't mean it's not accruing. It doesn't mean that some future creditor can't turn it on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all these different speculative claims. So it's almost one of those perfect storms for the industry where you don't know what to do. You don't know what to put in your letters. You don't know how to comply with these laws. And that's, at the very least, the Second Circuit has recognized that. During the Taylor oral arguments.
I'm interested, Katie, in what you've seen, and Arthur also, what you've seen with your clients as far as how the claims are couched. What I've seen are kind of two different sides to the argument. One, the collection letter, the communication was silent to the issue of interest and fees, and it's the claim that the debt collector failed to disclose that interest was not accruing. And then on the other side, I've also seen where that safe harbor language from the Miller case has been used in the letter. But the claim is, if no interest is accruing, then it's confusing or deceptive to use that safe harbor language. And those are the two instances I've seen as far as this being asserted. But I'm curious if you've seen any third or other types of argument on that.
Those are the main kinds of arguments that I'm seeing. And how to how to deal with those arguments really depends on who the defendant is. So here's what I mean by that. If the agency is collecting, for example, medical debt, where in most instances there's not going to be any interest accruing, that's the kind of case where, at least when I'm defending it, we don't make any offer. We engage in some limited discovery just to deal with the few issues in the case and set it up for a motion, because there's just no reason to engage in some lengthy process when it's very clear that interest is never going to be asserted. There's a couple other issues that come up if the creditor is a debt buyer or a financial institution, because there's a little bit more explaining to do if interest isn't running. And in a lot of the cases, interest isn't running because the creditor made a decision not to collect that interest. And they've then instructed the collection agency or law firm not to collect any interest. And that hasn't dissuaded plaintiff's counsel from still bringing these lawsuits. But luckily so far, the plaintiff's counsels haven't succeeded. And I just want to add, it's the same three or four law firms bringing virtually every case with this theory. And it's the same law firm that argued the Taylor case in the Second Circuit, where we're waiting for a court decision.
So let me ask you this, Arthur, if it's the same three or four firms, they're bringing all of these lawsuits, it doesn't seem like they're working. I know we can't read the minds of a plaintiff's attorney, but I mean, are they just hoping that eventually one of them they're going to hit and that'll be all they need?
I think what they're hoping for is that people will get tired of fighting these claims, will get tired of basically spending defense costs on these claims, and will settle. That's what they want, right? They want a quick settlement so they don't have to do any work and they get paid. So I think the best thing that agencies can do, especially if you feel your case is strong, is to fight these. Clog up those dockets, I guess it's not us clogging up the dockets, but fight the claims, show the courts this is what you've created, and make the courts deal with it and fix the issue.
So let me introduce an element of doubt now as far as this is concerned. This is all correct so far, and right now I'm aware of, I think we're up to 8 court decisions, all of which have been in favor of defendants dismissing cases, mostly on summary judgment, but I think a couple on a few of them on Rule 12. The problem is, one of those cases, the Taylor case, has been argued before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. There is a way to listen to the oral argument without going there, and I listened to the oral argument. I was not happy with what I heard from the bench, because the panel of judges seemed more receptive to plaintiff's arguments on the appeal. Now, I could simply be a little too nervous in my reaction, and maybe the court decision will go the right way, but I think that oral argument gives some comfort to plaintiff's counsel in believing that maybe the Court of Appeals will add an additional disclosure requirement on cases where interest is not running. I hope that's not the case, but I think it could happen, and I think we all have to plan for that possibility, unpleasant as it might sound.
Hey, Arthur, just to kind of follow up on that, since you were there for arguments, is it your feeling that the Taylor case was the wrong case to create precedent with, or is this just a matter of the Second Circuit does what the Second Circuit does?
Yeah, I don't know if it was the wrong case. I don't really think it was. By the way, there's another case in back of it, DeRosa, which I don't think has been scheduled yet. DeRosa against CAC Financial, which is also going to be argued, and that's maybe a little bit of a cleaner case. But I think one of the problems is one of the judges on the panel was on the first on Avila panel, and he seemed to think that. You know, drawing a line and saying that there should be some sort of written disclosure requirement sounded like a good idea to him. Now, what I don't know is whether he was speaking for the other two people on the panel or whether he was just speaking for himself and how strong his opinion was, because you can't tell just from listening. But I didn't really like hearing that, because I think it's very hard to impose a disclosure requirement when you're telling, you know, the balance we're seeking to collect really is the balance. It's really not going to change, and take our word for it, it really is correct. That's a harder and more awkward disclosure to make than the safe harbor language that applies when interest is running. And so I am nervous.
So one thing that I would say about that, I also listened to the oral arguments, and it is true. It did seem like the panel seemed to get stuck on this idea that plaintiffs have, that interest may not, the collection agency and the creditor may not be collecting interest at the moment, but it is still accruing, which I know a lot of us do not agree with that statement. We think it's a false statement. But two things that came up in the argument. For one, the Second Circuit did seem to recognize that their decision caused a lot of uncertainty and caused a ton of lawsuits to be filed against agencies who are just trying to comply with the law, and they don't know how to comply with the law. So I think the part that I'm worried about is that maybe they'll say, okay, well, there should be some disclosure, but it needs to be, like the plaintiff said, at some point in time in the future, depending on what a future creditor decides to do, maybe then your interest may accrue. But what brings me hope, and hopefully the Second Circuit does recognize this, is that type of a disclosure is so speculative. It is contingent on so many different things that are way outside of the control of the debt collection agency, that it is just not right to force a debt collection agency to say that, because then we'll see the type of suits that I claimed, that I mentioned earlier, that we are seeing, which is, well, you're complying with the Avila, but now you're creating this false sense of urgency, telling the consumer, hey, if you don't pay now, your interest is going to accrue sometime down the line, so pay now. And this is similar to one of the spinoffs of this argument, which is that prejudgment interest is accruing, which they've tried, you know, the consumer's attorneys have tried to argue, but that one's been shut down as well. The courts have found that is such a contingent and speculative event, there's no reason to disclose it to consumers in a letter. So hopefully the Second Circuit takes note and we get to a good place with that.
Yeah, Katie, I share your concerns. And from the collectors, the agency viewpoint, where I am coming from, you know, it's the idea of where you draw that line on what is reasonably certain versus speculative. And, you know, these arguments on these Avila and reverse Avila claims generally are tied to the interest issue, but they can, I think that can be spawned into a number of different things, late fees, attorney's fees, what have you, different things that might affect the consumer's ultimate burden to pay a debt. I think there's going to be a lot of creativity in the plaintiff's bar to expand that into a lot of other things that should be disclosed that they're not seeking or not disclosing if the Taylor decision goes the wrong way.
And of course, even if it goes the wrong way, I am hoping it doesn't, but even if it does, I don't think they can draw a blanket, just a black line, because some of the cases I'm defending right now, and as I mentioned before, involve agencies collecting medical debt, where there never was any interest run. You know, unlike a credit card where maybe interest is running at a certain time and then it stops, with a lot of the medical debt, then it just, it never ends. The claim was for a certain amount of money when services were rendered. The same amount is due 6 months later. The same amount is due a year later. And so the arguments the plaintiff makes that there has to be a disclosure, even when there's been three or four letters sent to the consumer, each with the same exact balance, just seems to me so silly and counterintuitive that I'm hoping that if the court reverses Taylor and certainly not a done deal, that the decision perhaps can be very narrow and only concern certain types of debt collection. At least that's my hope, because otherwise it's going to be a bright line that applies to cases where it just shouldn't apply, and it's going to create even more litigation than it's already created.
Yeah, Arthur, you know, we collect medical debt at my company, and I'd like to pull in something that Katie mentioned a minute ago, that issue of the prejudgment interest. So, you know, we don't have contractual interest on any of these accounts, but depending on what state you're collecting in, the argument is being made that prejudgment interest will apply to that, and, you know, unfortunately, there's bad language in certain cases in different states saying, you know, you can apply that to the date of default, to the date when collection or demand was first made. There's a lot of gray in the interpretation of that, but I've seen the argument being made against us that because you're collecting in a state that allows for prejudgment interest, that's going to pull in the Avila requirements on a whole host of different types of debts, not just ones where you've got a contractual claim event or right to interest.
Well, I mean, at least in New York, I mean, that those claims have been rejected, because in New York, you know, prejudgment statutory interest is collectible in certain instances, but usually those instances involve suing the consumer in court. So if the debt is being collected by an agency and it hasn't been sued, and maybe it's never going to be sued, you know, that sort of interest just doesn't get collected, and it's not collectible. So I think again that the courts have to understand the distinction between cases where the interest is running or where interest isn't. And sometimes I get the feeling that the courts, at least the federal courts, who aren't involved in debt collection except for the FDCPA cases, sometimes just don't understand the distinction.
I agree with that. I will say, you know, because New York is kind of the jurisdiction that is, you know, that's where Avila was based and has had the bulk of these type of trial court decisions and even court of appeals decisions, that's going in the right direction. I've seen the reverse as far as the statutory prejudgment interest claims go in Florida and California. So I don't think we can, if you're practicing in, you know, coast to coast in all 50 states, getting a standard, you know, operating practice that applies to every jurisdiction is going to be difficult. I know California, there's a Supreme Court decision or maybe a Ninth Circuit decision that analyzed their prejudgment interest statute under the Roosevelt Act and stated that it was certain to fall back or at least relate back to the date that demand was first made. And if somebody pulls a reverse Avila argument with that language, I think that's going to be a difficult one to get tossed on dismissal.
Let me jump in for a second and maybe start another area topic of discussion. We've talked a little bit about the problem. Let me try and see if we can get a sense of the scope of it. Katie, I'll ask you, can you provide some sense of how much these types of suits are growing or how many more we're seeing or anything like that?
Sure. So, I mean, I can speak from the perspective of my company. I'm not sure what other people are seeing, but I imagine it's a pretty similar trend. We saw a very sharp increase in these claims in spring of last year, spring of 2017, and we have not seen a decrease. It went up and then it stayed steady. So we receive roughly the same amount of these claims every month. And it there are so many of them. There are a lot. And most of them are oddly enough by the same plaintiffs' counsel who are filing multiple putative class actions on behalf of the same group of consumers for the same exact issue. So that's a fun one.
And from my perspective as a defense lawyer, just one defense lawyer, I have 15 open claims now that are virtually identical, except different plaintiffs and different defendants. And it would be more, except I have some clients who are risk averse and want to settle them right away, something I don't like to do, but obviously it's up to the client. So if you add those on, I've seen just in the last few months over 20 new cases. And they keep coming. Right now they're unabated despite the fact that the plaintiffs haven't succeeded. I guess they've succeeded in some respect because there are some settlements, usually not for a lot of money. The ones I'm fighting, you know, a lot of it is going to be dependent on the Second Circuit. Because I think the district judges, at least, seem to be in agreement. And now they're all starting to cite each other, which is good. Because it makes it less likely there's going to be an outlier that goes in the wrong direction. It'll all change if the Second Circuit decides that they want to put in a new requirement.
Okay. Are we seeing this... Are you seeing this dynamic or this strategy in pre-litigation demand letters, or is it just coming in the form of actual lawsuits?
Depends on the consumer attorney. For us, we see certain consumer attorneys who just file. They don't even bother with pre-lit demands. And then most of them, I feel, try to do the pre-lit demand because they don't want to spend the time and money to file it, to serve it, when they feel like they can get a quick settlement.
See, from my perspective, I don't usually see the cases until there's litigation. So I don't usually see the pre-lit demands, but the attorneys that file these cases the most often don't seem inclined to make pre-litigation demands. And so they file the lawsuit. And then they'll contact me once I'm in the case and immediately start talking settlement. But they don't seem to do it pre-litigation. I don't know if that's everybody else's perspective as well, but from my end, that's what I'm seeing.
I'm going to consider myself lucky. We've only had a couple of these claims asserted against us, so don't have a broad history of it. But we, you know, our footprint isn't as, you know, as much in New England or on the West Coast. We're mostly in the Southeast. So I think there's some trickle down effect where it's just now hitting where we have a lot of operations. The places I have seen it are in Florida and California. And in both those instances, we had pre-lits asserted against us, nothing filed. And, you know, taking a strategic approach to that, you know, to me, this is the type of claim, unless it's been proven in court that there is a legitimate violation of federal law or state law for that matter. This isn't one that I plan to settle. I don't adhere to the nuisance value aspect of this at all.
And I agree with that approach completely. I think that if the plaintiffs can't point to a lawsuit or a court decision, that's in their favor. It facilitates against settlement. And I think too many of these cases get settled, and that puts money into the hands of the plaintiff's counsel, and it gives them the finances to bring more of these lawsuits and keep it going. I think it's well worth the money to defend these, to tell the plaintiff's counsel that the only way you're going to win is if a court grants a motion in your favor, because otherwise you're not seeing any money. And a lot of, you know, some of these lawyers are not well capitalized, you know, with exceptions. And I think some of them can be scared off if they see that every case is going to be a battle. And I don't know that we're battling often enough. And I realize it's very easy for me to say that because it's not my money. but I think it's something that should be considered when an agency or law firm is a defendant. If the plaintiff can't point to a success on his cause of action, that should facilitate against settlement.
So let me ask you this, without obviously getting in too deep into specifics, Arthur, the cases that you're where your client is looking is not interested in settling versus the cases where they have settled, how has that discussion gone between you and the clients, and how have you been able to sort of convince, or how hard do you have to convince the ones who are fighting not to settle?
Well, it goes differently depending on the clients. Some of the bigger agencies have in-house counsel who are aware of the case law, and that's an easier discussion because they're already aware of how other cases have gone, and they know how to report this to the owners of the agencies. It's a more involved discussion when you're dealing with a smaller collection agency who doesn't have an in-house lawyer, who may be seeing this kind of case for the first time and is asking, how they could change their collection letters, or should they change them, and what are we going to do about the case? And then that requires a little bit more discussion, including a discussion about budget, unfortunately, because there's always a decision to be made about whether it's worth fighting or settling. And everybody has a different risk tolerance. The good thing is I do a number of work for different carriers, and the carriers have been behind fighting these on the cases where the agencies want to fight. Interestingly enough, more agencies are willing to fight this than lawyer defendants. I'm not sure I have a theory as to why, but they're easier to convince that a case should be fought than some of the collection law firms, at least the ones in the New York metropolitan area that have been sued. Maybe because some of the law firms have been sued several times.
Hey Arthur, can I ask you a question? I'm just curious, when you mentioned, some lawyers like to encourage settlement of these, and you're not sure why. And I'm wondering if it's because it's a convoluted argument to make to a judge as far as why this type of a claim doesn't hold water. And do you find that to be something, the threshold to educate a judge on the issues and why there's no precedent for this type of claim, is that something that's difficult to do?
Well, so far, it's time-consuming to do it. I don't know if the word is difficult. I don't consider it difficult, but it's not something you can do at the first court appearance and immediately tell the judge, this is why the plaintiff is going to lose the case, and the judge turns to the plaintiff and says, drop the case. I mean, I wish that was the case, but it's not. It is a process. And there does have to be some discovery, and then there has to be a motion. And so, that all takes time. Some people are more patient than others. Some clients are more patient than others in coming to a resolution. From my standpoint, I'm very patient. I'd rather that we get a good court decision. On the other hand, I'm not going to make a motion if I don't think I'm going to win it. But it's always going to be the client's. It's always going to be the client's decision. But I don't think anyone's really concerned that we're not going to convince the judge. People are more concerned about the cost of going through the process, and whether they're going to have to do it a second time and a third time, and whether it's cheaper to just settle. And everybody takes a different viewpoint.
So the benefit these days is that, especially over the past couple of months, a lot of these cases that agencies chose to fight from the get-go are starting to get decisions. And those decisions, as was mentioned previously, seem to be heavily in favor of defendants. So these days, it's a little bit easier to, if you receive a claim, say, okay, we're going to fight it. You're not really probably going to do a motion to dismiss because there have been several decisions that denied a motion to dismiss, basically saying, no, we need more facts on this to be able to make this decision. But on a very early summary judgment motion, it's feasible to, I guess, move these claims along quicker than it was maybe a year ago. So I think that's the benefit of the environment right now. But again, as Arthur mentioned, this could all change with what the Second Circuit decides in Taylor. Hopefully they decide in favor of the industry and find that these kinds of disclosure are just way too speculative to give, but who knows?
And the good thing,
sorry. Well, I was just going to piggyback on that. What the arguments I've seen from consumer attorneys on that has been just that well, such and such court refused to dismiss this type of claim, so therefore it must be valid. And that's kind of where they're based, the validity of that argument, just because one judge in some jurisdiction refused a Rule 12 motion, which is not the same as saying we have precedent, yes, it's good, yes, it's not, or no, it's not good, or that it's gone past the summary judgment stage as a valid claim.
And I just want to comment on that. Rule 12 is such a bad idea in these kind of cases. Because with the Rule 12, you can't introduce any affidavits or any real evidence. And in order to win these cases and be successful, you need an affidavit from the client saying that we're not charging interest and our client told us not to. And sometimes something from the creditor client saying, no, we're not charging interest. And so that's all something that can be put into a summary judgment motion. And so the court has all the facts. I think when the court sees that, the defendant wins. I mean, there were two court decisions just this week, both good ones. One just a couple days ago against Vengroff Williams. Vengroff Williams won in the Eastern District of New York in a court decision in which the judge cited most of the older cases that were beneficial to our side. So I think if it's handled the right way and the information is brought to the court's attention, and it's done the right way, we can succeed.
I kind of feel like I have to ask this question, even though I know there's probably no chance of going to get a straight answer from any of the panelists, but I'm just curious if anybody can kind of give a sense in some way, shape, or form, the difference in cost between fighting and settling in this specific instance. Is there any way that you can kind of try and quantify that for those who are listening in?
So I won't give dollar values, obviously, but there are many things to weigh in making that decision. One very strong one being that when you fight these cases, you make it very difficult for the plaintiff's counsel to get their money because that's all they care about. They don't care about the consumer. They don't care about anything but getting their payday. Whereas when you settle them, you make it very quick, which in my personal opinion makes you a quick, an easy target, essentially. They'll, I don't know if they do this or not. I'm assuming they do, but if they know that agency A is going to make it really hard, they're going to have to do a ton of work. They may win a lot of money in the end, but they'll have to do a lot of work to do it. They might think twice about filing suit or bringing a claim against that agency. On the other hand, if an agency settles within a week of receiving the pre-lit claim, that's easy money for them. So the dollar value, I think you'd have to look at long-term because fighting three lawsuits may seem like a more expensive option now, but in the long term, settling these claims without putting up any sort of a fight could encourage the plaintiff's counsel to bring a larger volume of them, which in the end would add up to costing more than it would have to defend some of these suits.
Mike, for us, it's hard to compare apples to apples. I mean, for us, we won't settle a case unless we've done something wrong. So the ones that we fight, we don't think that there's any merit to it. So it's hard to value them equally. I will say, we kind of made a strategic change to not settle matters, demands, or lawsuits just for the nuisance factor about a year and a half ago. And our per matter cost, settlement and fees combined, has dropped about 70%. So you know, there's I think real value in putting up the fight where the fight should be fought.
And I'll weigh in as well from my standpoint. You know, if you're only being sued once and you're convinced that you will never be sued again, then it's cheaper to settle than to fight. But one never knows that to be true, and it's usually not true. Usually, if you're sued once, you're going to be sued again. And if you accept that logic, then it becomes cheaper in the long run to fight a case and win. Because if you get sued again after you've won the first case, well, you already have your roadmap to success. And it doesn't become as expensive to fight it the second time, or God forbid the third time. But if you keep settling, that money just keeps leaving your wallet and it becomes more expensive. And so that's what I found in defending these cases.
We've got a question that came in. Again, if anyone has a question, by all means, enter it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. We're not quite out of time yet, but we're getting close. So here's a question. How many of you recommend creating a new disclosure to prevent getting these cases and perhaps in anticipation of the Second Circuit creating their own safe harbor for these non-interest accruing accounts?
That's the good question.
Yeah. And obviously you'd have to consult with your own legal counsel, and this is not meant to be legal advice to anybody over here, but the difficulty with this is that I think the disclosure that a lot of us are thinking, if the Second Circuit creates a disclosure, it will probably say something along the lines of interest is currently not collected or accruing, but it may at some point in the future. If you change it now and the Second Circuit decides, well, no, actually we don't want a disclosure for accounts that aren't accruing interest, then you run the risk of whichever letters have that language in it, getting claims saying that it's creating a false sense of urgency, similar to what I said earlier. And based on the claim that I mentioned we received recently, where the plaintiff's counsel argued that, or is arguing that, hey, even if you comply with the Avila Safe Harbor, the second prong of the Avila Safe Harbor, it's still a violation of the FTCPA because you're creating a false sense of urgency. So I can see you, even if the Second Circuit decides that is exactly the disclosure to have a safe harbor, you will probably still see claims saying that it creates a false sense of urgency. Whether those claims will be successful, I don't know, but that won't stop them from bringing these types of claims, in my
Yeah, Katie, I'll parrot what you say. That's very good advice. I would never, as a general rule, want to change a practice or add language to their letters or add an obligation just in anticipation of a court case, unless it's a best practice otherwise. Now, this would not be a best practice. The type of disclosure that may be being contemplated in the Taylor case, I think it's confusing, first of all. And secondly, as Katie mentioned, I think there's a definite overshadowing issue if that's included on your validation letters. The narrow issue is in those situations where interest is not accruing, whether there's an obligation. And, you know, if you've got a mix of accounts where some creditors charge interest and others don't, I think there's going to be a logistical it's going to be a logistical issue to really work through those. And I would really be very wary of the overshadowing issue because of that sense of urgency where they have to pay now, or there's an implicit threat of future interest or something like that.
So there was a follow-up to the question we had in a, where the person asking that, I was thinking more like a disclosure that says the balance shown above is the full amount due and not going to change. If you pay the amount shown above, you will satisfy the account. And again, that I'm not sure if I would recommend that either, because that's not going to stop the Barche Sanders of the world bringing the exact claim that they're bringing, saying, hey, you, or more so bringing a claim that I kind of alluded to, how this, that's out of the agency's control. So how can the agency say this for sure? How can you know what a future creditor may or may not do? long story short, the opposite of what they're trying to argue now. So it's, I don't know. I personally probably wouldn't change anything until Taylor comes out. But again, depending on each agency's personal or professional decision and speaking with their own counsel, it may be something you consider, but I would be wary of it.
I wouldn't either. Yeah, I mean, I poke a lot of holes and stuff like that. And you know, we had an instance, not a reverse Avila claim, but one where we had disclosed collection charges were zero on an account. We weren't charging a collection fee on the account. And we got a class action asserted against us because the argument was, well, there's an implicit threat behind that you will at some point in the future if you're not doing it now. And you can explain away with all sorts of exculpatory language all day long. I just don't think it would be effective and certainly not get it. It's not going to prevent claims from being filed against you.
Yeah, and I understand the desire to act proactively and try to make a change in anticipation of a court decision. The problem is it's so hard to anticipate what the court's going to do. If the court doesn't come to the conclusion that the language they recommend is exactly the same as the one you've chosen for your new letters, you immediately become a renewed target. And even if the plaintiffs don't win against you, you're still inviting more litigation. And so it just puts you in a hard place when you want to be proactive, not being able to predict what an appeals court's going to do or whether it's going to agree with the proposed new wording of your letters.
I will say I would be more concerned about what the CFPB's rulemaking might state as far as disclosures in the validation notice or any collection notice on that point. And if you think back, and you know, we all know that the CFPB, what the future of the rulemaking is kind of, we don't know what it's going to say. But if you look back at the outline that they released about a year and a half ago, their proposed validation language had that itemization of charges, adjustments, interest, fees, everything on that required to be disclosed. And there was no exception, I don't believe, if there was zero interest or zero charges being made on that. I just think, assuming that some form of that is going to be in the new rulemaking for the FDCPA, you're just going to have to change again to comply with that. And it's reconciling those two is going to be a difficult thing.
All right, four of those agencies that either have or will now, you know, stand up and say, I'm not going to settle, I'm going to fight this lawsuit, I'm going to defend it. Is there a progression of steps or a common strategy that should be followed, or is it different depending on the, you know, the idiosyncrasies of every case?
As I mentioned earlier, I think now it's probably recommended to just do a very, very early summary judgment motion, citing all the cases in Eastern District of New York that have found for the defendants on this exact issue. But then, of course, that would depend on, I guess, what they're alleging. But as we mentioned before, motion to dismiss, probably not ideal in this situation because it requires a bit more factual information than is probably provided in the pleadings. But I mean, there really is no need to do formal discovery in this, in my opinion. It's just a quick summary judgment motion right off the bat. I think there's enough case law right now in Eastern District of New York to do that.
And just piggybacking off of what Katie just said, it's not that hard to do a summary judgment motion because there's so few facts in these kind of cases that you can work with your adversary to get a statement of agreed upon facts that can be jointly submitted. And there may be a little bit of discovery necessary to do that, but not a lot. And so that way the court really just has a question of law to decide because all the facts are no longer in dispute. As soon as you have disputed facts, then you want to hesitate before making the motion to see what's disputed. It's not that hard to make the motion. And each motion now has one more case to cite because the decisions have been good. So as long as they continue and there's no reversals, we're in good shape.
I generally agree with that strategy. I do think it's worth just putting the caveats out there. If, you know, once you get to the summary judgment stage with limited discovery, you know, we've had plaintiff's counsel demand copies of our underlying contracts with the creditors, which is something I deem to be proprietary, and I don't like to disclose those and things like that. So if your argument is based on, well, this by contract they can never charge interest, then you have to be able to prove that and be willing to show that. We have pushed the threat of motion to dismiss on the front end, like a failure to state a claim motion, just because Avila has not been adopted in every circuit. So if you're outside of the Second Circuit, I do think there is some value to keeping that within your cachet of strategic options.
Okay. Before we get to wrapping up, I wanted to ask, you know, each of you, do you think that we will see, or are we already seeing, maybe we'll start to see more of, you know, we're talking about one particular, you know, sort of segment, in terms of what, you know, what the reverse Avila lawsuits are going after. We talked a little bit about late fees, attorney fees. I mean, do you see this progressing on into other areas of what's being collected, or will it kind of stop and start here?
I think that really depends on the decision in Taylor. If Taylor finds and requires some disclosure that we have to disclose something that may or may not happen later in the future, then I can foresee the plaintiff's counsel bringing these claims, decide, well, okay, you didn't tell the consumer that he may or may not be sued sometime in the future. You didn't tell them that the account may or may not be sold in the future. And so they'll probably think of a million other things, and then we'll be doing this whole battle again, trying to tell the courts this is getting silly. There's not enough space on the paper to put in everything that will or may not happen on an account. And then also, one thing to keep in mind is this, you know, these Avila claims are just the claim du jour. It's, you know, a few years ago it was barcodes, last year it was 1099C, this year it's Avila. They'll always think of something. So for better or worse, we're always going to have to deal with things like this unless the Second Circuit really puts down and tries to mitigate the issue of clogged dockets, essentially. But even then, I still think that these attorneys aren't going away, right? This is their livelihood. This is how they make a living. So they're going to try to find their next payday somehow.
And I agree with that completely. I think these Avila cases, these reverse Avila cases, are the hot issue now. 6 months from now, it's going to be completely different. Either the court's going to affirm Taylor, in which case there won't be any new cases brought with these fact patterns because it won't be possible to win them, or there'll be a reversal and there'll be a flurry of new cases, but the agencies and law firms will all be making changes to their letters. And so after the flurry, it'll eventually stop. But I, everything is really dependent on the Court of Appeals. And I think once the Court of Appeals makes their ruling, lawyers in other jurisdictions may be taking notice, and which may lead either to an increase in claims or just the ending of those type of claims altogether. You know, it's just a guessing game as to what the Court of Appeals is going to do at the moment. But it's certainly going to affect the future of these claims in a big way.
Excellent. Before we wrap up, since there don't seem to be any other questions in the queue, I'd like to give each of the panelists a chance to sort of share some parting words or parting thoughts, and then we'll wrap up. So, Judd, I want to start with you.
Yeah, I guess what I would couches the best takeaways from this. I mean, these are real claims that are being asserted, but I don't think an agency or debt buyer or whoever is on the receiving end of these claims, I don't think there's anything prompting a change in operating practices. I think it's just you have to be able to respond to these demands accordingly. And without having any any court really recognize this yet. I'm still in the mind frame that we need to address them aggressively and defend them aggressively. Up until some authority says this is a legitimate claim and you need to change your business practices accordingly, I'm not there yet, so we're going to defend them.
Okay, thank you. Katie?
So for me, one thing that I would really, really love to see is our industry to be more proactive and more on the offense instead of the defense on these issues. I mean, obviously we're defendants, but to take a firmer stance, to fight these claims, fight these plaintiffs' counsel, I know it's a very difficult decision and it's really going to depend on your budget, the size of your company, the types of claims. And I know it's difficult to choose to fight a lawsuit when it's going to cost tens of thousands, who knows how much dollars, when you can just settle for five. But I think that short of rewording the FDCPA to change the attorney fees provision, the only real way we're going to get some sort of relief from these plaintiffs' counsel is if we force them to fight. And again, difficult decision to make, but in my ideal world, we would be fighting everything. But obviously that's the
world. And I'm sure Arthur will agree with that. Go ahead, Arthur.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I'm of the opinion that you generally don't settle a case unless the plaintiff can point to a reason based on case law why he should win. And right now, the plaintiffs can't point to a reason or to a case that supports their position. So until the Court of Appeals rules otherwise, and it may not, I think the decision needs to be made to fight these cases and not give easy paydays to these people. It's not beneficial to the industry to give easy paydays to consumer counsel. You want to make their job as unprofitable as possible, so there's less of them to come after us. And so I think you fight the cases that need to be fought. There are enough cases where a mistake has been made, where a debt buyer has to pay some money out. To pay it when there's no mistake been made just goes against my grain. And I certainly would want anyone in that position to just consider those calculations and consider those possibilities.
Excellent. We did get a comment about people submitting cases to the ACA Industry Advancement Fund. ACA will pay for people to fight good cases and has done so many times in the past. So thanks for that comment. Before I let everybody go, I wanted to thank Arthur, Katie, and Judd for their insights and their time today. This webinar definitely would not have been possible without their participation. I mean, let's face it, no one would have probably signed up to hear me talk about reverse Avila lawsuits for an hour. So thank you to the three of them. Also wanted to thank Barron and Neuberger for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.bn-lawyers.com to learn more about the firm. Thank you to everybody who signed up. Thank you to everybody who asked questions and participated. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future, as well as a recording of this event will be posted in the next couple of days. And I hope everybody enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.